Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 348th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta. And in the office today, we have Dr. Mike Kolber, who is an associate professor. You might have been promoted.
No. I don't even think he has a job.
Yeah. Or maybe he was demoted.
Yeah.
I have private.
That's right.
Yeah.
And corporal.
Yeah, exactly.
And so rather than maligning, this is not a maligning Mike Kolber podcast, but it is.
That was last week, wasn't it?
Yeah. But it is urgent.
Yes, it is. There's something urgent we have to talk about. This one was, this is from a recent Tools for Practice that Mike did with one of our residents, I think Dr. Hackett, is that right?
Or you bet.
Am I getting that right?
Yeah. You bet. So one of our rural residents. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, and it was on a question that does come up on occasion and generates fear. And one of the things that we do often when we talk about hypertension is we'll show one of the first hypertension trials. And in that trial, which was entitled The Treatment of Mild Hypertension with Propranolol, their average hypertension there, I think, James, was somewhere around 200 on 110.
Correct.
Yeah.
And most people, even seeing those numbers, get a bit panicky.
So, we get hypertensive seeing those numbers.
I know. So let's talk about what is really urgent and markedly elevated and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and kind of what to do about it.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. So we see this not uncommonly. We see it in emergency departments often when people are upset or in pain or worried. And in our office, especially if we're not taking our blood pressures accurate and we're getting numbers that are really, really high. And you know, in the old days, I think we'd go nuts. We'd jump. We'd send them to Emerge. And, mm-hmm. and then now we're kind of going, oh, mate, is that the right thing? So we really want to look at this and see where we're at. So
sorry to interrupt. Well, not really sorry, but it doesn't matter. and you know, 30 years ago or 40 years ago, there was a lot more of this because, you know, people were not treated really at all. And so,
right.
You know, you'd see these people coming in with blood pressures of, you know, 250 over 130, but you just don't see that anymore. But it is still possible, but not nearly to the same degree. Yet, unfortunately, I think the fear that was associated with those people, we've sort of migrated to anybody whose blood pressure is a little bit above 140, we get nervous. And so that's the whole point of this podcast.
Right. Or classically, we'll have somebody with a blood pressure of 160 over 98 or 100 and they have a headache.
Yeah.
And your job is to tease out, and you know, invariably, I'm not trying to downplay, obviously, emergencies are obviously high blood pressure with symptoms, whether it be headaches or chest pain and those kind of things. Yeah. And obviously those are the ones that we need to send to Emerge and actually treat them appropriately with the intravenous medications. But again, we always get these cases often. It seems to always come up with a learner when they come in and we've got a headache and we think we need to do this, and this. And so we really need to have, I think, a reasonable approach.
Yeah.
Backing up, like Mike said, that initial mild hypertension study, I think that was a trial and they shut it out after 8 patients. So the propranolol, it was propranolol versus placebo, and they found, whoa, the propranolol people are doing great and the placebo people aren't, and they shut that one off.
Well, at least from there was no outcomes, but they you were able to actually lower blood pressure.
Yeah.
Go figure.
And so same thing when you look back, and we look back, and some of this early stuff, like Mike had said, was from the 60s, and this was a VA study, and this was looking at placebo versus hydrochlorothiazide, reserpine, or hydralazine. And after 143 patients, they ran them for about 18 months, and same thing. They said, well, we got to stop this early because the placebo group had about a 40% event rate, whether it be retinal hemorrhage, so your eyes are bleeding, your brain bleeds, you have dissection of an aneurysm, MI or heart failure or death, and the treated people actually had a 3% risk. And so, wow, those numbers needed to treat, it's 3, and you don't often see these differing. So good on them that they shut that off, but yeah. I agree.
And that was called the VA1 trial. And it was the very first trial ever done of hypertension. And like you said, I don't know if you mentioned it, but their average blood pressure was 186 over 120.
Just a bit outside.
Outside, yeah. But back, you know, like I said, that was not, we didn't actually know if that did anything.
Right, in the 60s.
In the 60s, and if you treated that. But what's interesting is that even at 18 months, with people with 186 over 121, 60% of people didn't have anything happen to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fair.
You know, and
yeah,
I'm, fair. So I'm not, and you know, when you actually look at the endpoints in that study, you know, if we were strictly limited to just the hard endpoints of things like heart attacks and death and so on that we often stick to in these other trials, the numbers weren't quite as big as that. They still were more than impressive enough that you would go, almost anybody, if they could tolerate treatment, would want it for that. But it's but it was interesting because that literally was the first trial, and that, like you say, that was not considered like urgent hypertension. It was just they got a bit of an elevation in blood pressure.
Yeah, they're just up there a tiny bit.
Yeah.
And you're right, James. A lot of this was driven by retinal hemorrhage, but I think even if you took those out, the conclusion of the story is still similar.
Exactly
that
we obviously the same.
Treated these guys, and we probably all would agree that, you know, 180 is more important than 170 and 160, and where you actually draw that J curve. And so this is now the nuance is now the 2000s. So I'll take you forward to some actually very interesting cohort data. So the largest one, and I was fascinated to run across this one, almost 60,000 American outpatients. So going to see either your family doc or internist. And this was on, I believe, a central electronic system. So you're actually able to retrospectively look at all these things. These patients had a mean blood pressure 185 over just under 100. And 73% were known hypertensive and often on two medications or more. And 25% had known cardiovascular disease. And so they actually followed these guys forward, retrospectively followed them forward, and tried to figure out what they had at 6 months. So at 6 months, this group of patients, so with a blood pressure in your office of 185 over 96, had a risk of coronary heart disease, stroke, or a TIA about 1.2%. They also wanted to try to evaluate the subgroup of patients that were sent to eMERGE. So again, you're in your office, you send them to eMERGE, and there was no difference. There was a small subset. So I think because it's kind of, this is one of our newest, largest studies, they've actually already figured out that most of these people don't have to go to eMERGE, that there was no difference in these outcomes, although the people that went to eMERGE were probably a very, very small subset of this. What I think that is the really major limitation in this, and this, I think this study took a little bit of media and actually was promoted a bit, was that if you look at all of these visits, when you look at it, almost 5% of our visits were for this problem, meaning 5% of all the patients coming through the door had this kind of blood pressure, and I believe it had to be over 180 over around 180 over 110 and or one or the other. And you go, gosh, so I wonder if there's a bit of a measurement error, meaning you slap – we all know what busy offices are like. The nurses are running. You slap the cuff on and you get this high number and then everybody panics as opposed to doing it right and doing the five readings.
Yeah.
So kind of the pros and cons of a pragmatic trial where you don't really tell them how to do things, but this is what you get. So I just wonder if how they initially measured blood pressure might have been a little bit inaccurate to get them in this study.
Well, yeah. So, well, given like it's a cohort study, but no, you're absolutely right. And you know that's one of the things that, you know, if when you're measuring blood pressures like that, if in your office and you know there's nurses everywhere and everyone's screaming and yelling, and you measure blood pressure and it's 100 over 60, you're fairly comfortable. But you're right. If it's 180 over 110, that's when you got to do it properly. But for sure, you know, a number of these people would have had those numbers on repeat measurements probably.
We just don't know the nuances of it as well. So again, I guess the teaching point number one is when you get those things and they're asymptomatic, I'd again put them in a quiet room, do the five numbers and dollars to donuts. Like you guys said, 90% of them will float down to a area that you're nice enough that you go, oh, Mr. Smith, how you doing? Oh, I ran out of those pills. Or again, a lot of the themes that come out of these studies also is that many of them are known hypertensive people. And they're either not taking their pills or have another reason, whether it be alcohol or other things, pain, that actually is putting their blood pressure up. So, yeah, you bet. So measuring me accurately, quiet, you'll be amazed how many times that comes down. There was a great study in Austria. And basically, so looking at the other way, so recruitment from an emergency department. So they're coming with blood pressures greater than 220 over 120, so pretty decent. And they actually followed after they gave them some oral treatment in eMERGE, actually followed them down the road. They had numerous investigations. They had follow-up with like internal medicine in a day or so. So again, kind of almost the best of the best. And for these guys, at 4 years, they had a 23% risk of cardiovascular disease, heart failure, atrial fibrillation. So you go, oh, okay, so 4 years, 23%. Man, these blood pressures are pretty high to start with. Mm-hmm. If you look at Swiss primary care outpatients, again, with the family doc, these blood pressures were about 200 over 100. They tried to specify whether these people were asymptomatic, urgent, like non-specific symptoms that we see, dizzy and headache, which is many people have dizziness and headaches, but we don't think they're related to the blood pressure, and also following these guys. And again, after about a year, they had, again, one of the problems is differing definitions. So these guys included cardiovascular disease, heart failure, peripheral vascular disease. So again, the numbers are all changing depending on what you're looking at as far as outcomes. And these ones were about 13%. These ones were enrolled, and then the outcomes were based on the family doc. And so either, I mean, you hope that, that they're actually presenting a true and honest mm-hmm. reflection of what actually happened. And then just counteract to that. So I think one of the things is it really depends on who you have in your study. So there was another emergency department study of American inner city African Hispanics, and they actually had a mean blood pressure of about 210 over 130 in the eMERGE department. Many of them had nonspecific symptoms like we talked about, but again, they've already pre-selected that they're in eMERGE. 50% of these ones had known cardiovascular disease. Again, it's who you have in the study will probably determine what your outcomes are and what your outcomes are measured. And many of these guys were given oral agents, clonidine. Most of them had no follow-up, and who came back to eMERGE. And so at 1 month, 14% of these people came back to eMERGE with cardiovascular disease, heart failure, or encephalopathy. So that's, I think that's the worst of the worst, and that's kind of highlights some of our, we talk about social determinants of health and driving outcomes, and I think these are, they have a whole bunch of things against them, whether it be their inner city, the financial inability to navigate the system, inability to pay for their meds, and even where to go. If they say follow up with a family doctor, they may say, I don't even know where that is or how that goes. Yeah. So you see a whole range. And so I think the difficulty with a lot of these cohort studies are you have a different group of people that are starting. You have a different thing that you're doing. You may or may not be diagnosing them accurately. You have a different what you're actually giving them, whether it's a lot of follow-up, hand-holding, making sure they take their pills, paying for their pills, versus just seeing how things go. You have differing outcomes. And even how you diagnose hypertensive urgency really changes. If you look at four different papers, you'll say some of them say you have to have 220. Other ones will say 110 as far as diastolic. So it's not surprising that it's all over the place. And I think those things are probably more important drivers of our outcomes as opposed to the actual treatments. I think all of us would treat these patients with one or two oral agents. And that's probably another implementation piece or point is that if somebody really has a true blood pressure of 200 over 100, you're probably going to be just fine giving them a combo agent, and you'll probably improve adherence with a combo agent mm-hmm. and you're not going to bottom them out. And I think that that's probably really important as well.
Yeah, but now these are all so none of these trials, and I think it's important to realize that the very first trial we talked about was an RCT showing the benefit of treating the 186s over the 121s, but none of these trials give us information about did treatment do anything.
Yeah, the studies. None of the cohort studies tell you about. They can describe what your risk of events are for that subpopulation or that type of people for those events. But as Mike said, they're so variable. I think they do lend to the idea, though, that how important the social determinants of health are, mm-hmm. right? They do suggest, again, when you're talking about 1 month, 14% having an adverse event, and in another study, it was 13% at a year. Mm-hmm. And so I think we're seeing here that those differences manifesting themselves in the awful way that they do. So that's part of it. And as Mike indicated, or I think in the tools for practice, and he can talk about it a little bit, is how important things like, are you actually taking your medicines? Those kind of things actually are. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, some of the common themes, Mike, across this were, I think about 75%, if I was going to ballpark a number, of these people that were included in these cohort studies were actually known hypertensives, and a good subset of them were just not taking their pills. Yeah. And not surprising. It also brings to the fact that we're worrying about blood pressures 145 over 92s and stuff. And I think the most important thing we could probably do for them is actually take that pill and give it to the person that really needs it or can't afford it. And again, so we may be treating the right number of hypertensives, but maybe the wrong ones. And again, that law of diminishing returns. And if you have somebody that has really true blood pressure this high, if it obviously this is beyond looking for a secondary cause. I mean, obviously we mm-hmm. twig on and say, geez, maybe it's a secondary cause and there might be something else. And that's beyond this podcast. But just making sure that they're actually taking their medications and some of the non-pharmacological things, which may or may not have some evidence for as well. So yeah, this is a challenging one. This is like trying to put your finger on, how your kids have the putty stuff and it keeps moving all over the place. Mm-hmm. And it's like, so what is the diagnosis? Well, it changes. And what are the outcomes? Well, it depends on what study you read. But I think some of the principles probably make sense. some of the things we used to use, so we didn't talk about, is that when I was first a student, we used to use oral nifedipine and put it under the tongue and thought we did a great job taking them from 200 to 140.
How many calls did you get on
that? Yes, we got lots of calls for that. I mean, that's kind of dating us. That should not be done. So the exact timing, we don't really know exactly how quick we should take them from 200 to maybe like 160-ish.
Yeah.
And then kind of just pull them there and then just see how it goes. We don't have that exact timing, but what we do know is if we try to obviously correct this in minutes to hours, we're probably doing more harm than good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you can sort of make some sort of assessment, even if you go back to that one, the very first VA trial, where these people that were enrolled in this trial are different than what we are now seeing today.
Absolutely are. Yep.
So these guys have they're 190 over 120.
Yep.
Over 18 months, and you know, this is over 18 months. So again, I'm going to go back to 60% of people didn't have an issue. The tricky part is not whether or not these people should likely be treated or at least offered treatment. You know, I don't think any of us are going, you know, a person whose blood pressure is 200 over 110 or whatever, there's clear evidence of benefit. The issue is how aggressive do you need to treat these people? And I think the evidence is pretty clear that if you have a true person whose blood pressure is 200 over 120, one medication probably won't get them down to any sort of a target that might even be ballpark reasonable. But I think what we're... But even if you sort of do the math on the risks associated with it, the risks, if they don't have any symptoms, like now if they come in with a headache, one of the key things I think, I don't know if you guys would agree, you got to think about, is it the headache that's causing the blood pressure?
Yeah, right. Yeah, you know, for sure.
And all those sorts
of things. Or vice versa. Is the hypertension causing the headache?
Exactly.
Or things. We know that, because of where we see people, again, if we're predominantly primary care, what we see might be a little bit different, and we see that often we see people with chronic headaches that have blood pressure or not, but it might be a little different as if we were in the inner city emergency department, that maybe we'd be seeing more of the symptom-based hypertensive emergencies.
Yeah, sure. That is, I will go as far as to say, almost impossible to sort out. You can get a sense for a tension headache or a new migraine, especially if the history's there.
Yeah.
But like a lot of times, it's hard to sort out. So you have to be a little more. You want to get that blood pressure down early on, but you need good follow up. As Bob used to say, there were a number of people who were hypertensive who later have pills withdrawn and are fine. Yep. So you have to be very cognizant of that. So
In fact, there's just talk about this in another podcast. There's just actually a systematic review of that just came out, I think, yesterday or today even, about withdrawal. And when you take people who've had blood pressures treated at, I think, 6 months, if you withdraw antihypertensive treatment, 40% will be normotensive at 6 months.
Of that, yeah.
Yeah, and then when you go out to 2 years, it's still 25%. Are normotensive, and that brings into the whole issue of why is that? Well, was it the wrong diagnosis? Were the measurements wrong? Was their blood pressure reset, and so on and so forth? But I think for this issue, and actually, I'd like to hear what you guys think about this, because you know we sometimes poke fun at what we did in the past, where you know a person would come in, and their blood pressures would be 190 over 120, and I remember dispensing things like you said, the sublingual nifedipine, and you know, you have to stick a needle into it and squeeze it under their tongue, or giving sublingual captopril and all that sort of stuff. And all of that was done with, I don't think, a shred of evidence. Because even if you look at so let's say their risk of a bad event over 18 months is 40%. I can't imagine that the risk over 4 hours is almost anything. Now, if they come in and normally their blood pressure is 100 over 60 and they're coming in and it's 180 over 110, that makes a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know, the big changes and so on. So when would you guys do, so what would you guys do? A person comes in with no symptoms and on repeat measures, you know, let's say you're in your office, it's 180 over 110. What would you guys do?
I would look in the records to see if there's any indication this person was approaching hypertension.
We mean with previous measurements.
Yeah. So if I could find that and they were this number, I might initiate treatment that day.
Mm-hmm.
If not, and they were asymptomatic and I had nothing, I would try and go over a history to find out, is there anything happening, like NSAIDs, you know, whatever. And if there was a suggestion, I would say, come back in a week and we'll retest you. And keep very close watch on them. So I try not to freak out about these, but have very, very close follow-up. If I can't be comfortable sending someone home, then I give them a whiff of something until I can see them again, just to get that number down a little bit.
Yeah.
Like Mike says, my goal is to get to around 160, and then I go much slower after that. I don't. I'm more aggressive to get there, and then I'm. And we know from other research, I think it was a meta-analysis by a guy named Law. I don't know if it was male or female, but they showed that the higher your number, the more bang for your buck you get from your pill. So, you know, if somebody's at 180, they get a much better reduction off a single or even two low dose pills than they get when they're at 140.
Yeah, for sure.
So I will often initiate treatment early. And I can't, this is terrible, but I can't, because I presented on it, but I can't recall about CHEP whether they say, is it at 180 you start right away, and then after that you have to have at least one follow-up appointment?
Yeah, so they say diagnose them at what? So you have to trust your measurement, but anything greater than 180 is
a start that day.
That is
it's a start
without a doubt. So I agree with what Mike said. I would just back up a little bit, really ensure it. Look what you have in the past. Often it's the same kind of person. Mm-hmm. You look at the cardiovascular risk, and often in my patient population, they have other risk, whether it be smokers. They're often not the most either athletic. Compliant, they're often not super compliant. So I would kind of look at who I have. I would just make sure the blood pressures are done. And as much as your office is busy, you know, it's a quiet room and it's five.
This is one where it's like a, you know,
this is an hour. This is an hour visit.
It can be a long visit. It doesn't. You don't have to be in the room for an hour, but you have to get that. You have to get that good reading, because if you just dismiss it and send them home and they did have this high reading and did nothing, I think that's bad management. Mm-hmm. And if you take one reading and jump on it and go, starting telmisartan and chlorothalidone at the same time. Yeah. You're not, and I picked telmisartan because I know that's your favorite, James. So, you know what I mean? Like you really have to be careful here.
Yep.
And the best way to be careful is actually, it doesn't require that much from the clinician. You put them in the room, you put them on that monitor. Now, for those who are still using manual cuffs, I think you have to spend the time to take a bunch of readings.
You need the ability to have a multi-reader in your office, an automated multi-blood pressure reader, you bet. We're not paid for by those guys by any stretch, but I mean
it actually saves you so much time.
Saves you time, effort, and actually more makes the – I think allows you to treat the people you want to be treating and not treating people that are –
and do things like take away their cell phone or say you can't talk at all. Yep. Because if you catch them, if they're on their cell phone while you're out seeing the next patient trying to get these good readings, I think, Mike, it's the number is 17.
17. So, so I would just really make sure I got the right person. So proper size cuff. We have the little sheet that says how to take a proper blood pressure where your legs are not crossed. But, talking 17. And proper cuff about 10. So again, you add those things up, and if you don't
those are the things that have been shown to elevate,
falsely elevate things. Yeah. So again, if you don't do that correctly, boy, you may have like the large study we talked about earlier. You may have 5% of all your visits coming through the office and going, wow, I'm spending a lot of time dealing with these people that are sick.
It's such an important thing, and you feel bad because you know these patients, they love to talk. There's a subset who love to talk to you, and you have to say to them, I'm sorry. Whatever their name is, I'm just going to have to ask you to be quiet while we're taking these readings, because, you know, if they're at 180 and 17 of that is talking,
you don't have any sort of an issue.
Correct. And so I would agree with you, Mike. I would probably, if I was confident that these numbers, and again, we treat people, not numbers, but if I was confident that these numbers were over at the level that I thought I should treat, I probably would initiate treatment then. I agree with you. See them, see how they're doing with compliance, start them with a low-dose med, see how they're doing next week kind of thing. Obviously, fire off some baseline labs based on what we're treating them on. I don't think I'd walk away.
You'll get burned once in a while. I had a guy who was exactly, I can't remember male or female, but that met this
criteria. Not sure if the guy was male or female.
Yeah, not sure if the guy was. But I can't recall whether this patient was. And I followed what we just talked about, and the numbers were north of 180. So I initiated treatment, came back, and the numbers were all low. and then after a while tapered off all the medicines and were fine off pills.
Beautiful.
So whatever the heck was happening, and I have seen this in my practice a number of times where people come in with considerably high readings, north of 160, we manage them, and then over a while their numbers are low consistently, so you start to taper off and they can come off. So James, that study you were mentioning, there mm-hmm. is something that goes on for people where their pressures can be elevated for a, you know, a certain, like a 6 months year, where you intervene and then whatever was happening for them, God knows what it was, a brief endocrine dysfunction, you know, diet,
life stresses, or it could be
Stresses.
Right?
So, and so I think we, just as we have to view these as an emergency, we have to reflect on low numbers too when treated patients.
Yeah. And I think the biggest concern, I mean, if there was no potential for harm, we wouldn't have to worry about it. But you guys all know, and again, there's not a lot of great data on this, but you know, taking, if you take people from 200 over 110 and make them 100 over 60, often they feel crappy.
If nothing else happens, your life, if it's just feeling crappy, that's good. The good news.
I'm just saying that's the least.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and there is, in all the clinicians I've ever spoken to who do this sort of stuff, you know, do suggest that, you know, back, you know, 30 years ago when they did this, they may have caused strokes by.
We did with methadipine.
Yeah. You know, and so the issue about how aggressive do you need to be, you know, I think you the decision to treat is whether you're going to treat at 160, 170. Probably the process is very similar. And now I know, Mike, you said start with a combo. And if their blood pressure, the evidence is pretty clear. If their blood pressures are of those sorts of numbers, you do need more than one in almost everybody. But yeah. I still think, you know, just starting with a low dose of something.
Sure.
And both of you guys said, I think the key thing is proper follow-up.
Oh, yep. God, yeah.
And to say, and you know, and they could do it at home. You can go into a pharmacy. You can, you know, whatever it is, you're just trying to get, you know, some sort of ballpark idea of what's going on. And I'm not suggesting that every one of those types of measurements is perfect, but it's, you just want to make sure, you know, to see what happens.
Yeah. And don't hesitate to have that quick fall, even by phone call. I can think when the one guy that I tried to initiate sprint in, mm-hmm. you know, I said to him, call if there's any problem, but this is so true of so many patients, they don't call. So I was worried about him, so we called him. It was 2 weeks in, and he said to the nurse, I don't know if I should stay on this, I feel so crappy. And and I said to the nurse, like, why did he not call? Why is he well, he knew he had an appointment in a month.
Yes. Yeah.
So yeah, and obviously we stopped that in him, but this is an example of just how you, these things, as you say, James, can just make people feel crappy.
Yeah.
And so we have to be cognizant. Now at 180, 190, I think it's time to initiate. But after that,
yeah. But I think the conversation is part of the important conversation is, you know, with the amount of marketing around the silent killer thing, people go at 180, they're panicking, and you may be panicking. I don't think you guys would be, but you know, we got to. Sort of there's a lot of education that has to go on that I'm going to treat you with a low dose of something. If you really feel crappy, I need to know that not in a month.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
You know, because you know, it could be one, they're just having a side effect from the medication, but it could be because their blood pressure was not 180. It was actually 140 and now it's 110.
Yeah.
You know, and all those things. So it's frustrating that there isn't a lot of great data, but how do you even do a study of that?
And people do panic when their numbers are even north of 140, but certainly when they're up in the 160, 180,
yeah.
they are worried about it, which only makes their blood pressure worse. Yeah. So,
I think one of the things that I think is key, you know, for people who've been following the podcast, you guys know about this, the calculator that we use, but there are other Framingham calculators. A really useful thing is to do. These calculators allow blood pressures, I think, of 170, 180. You can put in the numbers and show this is your 5 or 10 year risk of 180 versus 160. And, you know, it is higher, but, you know, we're talking 3 or 4, 5, 6% over higher, maybe over 10 years. You can imagine what's the risk over 1 month. And we've got lots of stuff where we've done those sort of calculations. So the biggest issue is over-treatment in these guys, not necessarily under-treatment. But the key thing I think you guys mentioned is follow-up. So I don't know if we need to push it anymore because, again, this is all just personal opinion, given that we don't have RCTs of all of this stuff. But you just have to use some common sense and, you know, I guess do no harm, I guess.
Right.
I know that sounds kind of weird. Do no harm.
It's not that that's important or anything. It's in the hippopotamus oath, James.
Exactly. Right. So why don't we, what's the context? Any bottom lines that you want to give?
Sure. So, I mean, you talked about the only RCT information that we have from, almost 50 years ago now is that these people did have blood pressures of, 185 or 120, placebo versus treatment, and it made quite a bit of difference. Mm-hmm. So placebo had a 40% chance at 18 months. I guess if you're an eternal optimist, you say, well, you have 60% chance of nothing on the placebo, versus 3% if you actually treat them. I think that we talked about this was it's how are you actually making a diagnosis of are you actually diagnosing hypertension, or is it something else that's making you respond to the numbers? And I think that measurement accuracy and making sure who you're treating. I mean, obviously, if somebody's got cardiovascular disease and they also have renal failure and stuff, I mean, those blood pressures of 180 over 100 might be more meaningful than we talk about the UMA soccer moms that are walking through and there something else is going on. So I think that it's who you have, how accurate you're actually doing what you're doing. Follow up, and we talked about socioeconomic status and outcomes, and then probably some ethnicity. And I'm not an expert on the ethnicity and blood pressure in different ethnicities, but we know it's different for different folks. And I think it's probably who you have, not so much the numbers that really should be driving us one way or the other. We also say for symptomatic people, we don't want people coming across and saying we can just walk away from these people because we don't think it's important. If they're symptomatic and you think the symptoms are related to the blood pressure, then that is a phone call to your friendly emergency department, or if you're in a smaller town, you're taking them over yourself and doing it. And again, I think it's most times it could be, however, oral agents and a reasonable follow-up. And then, like you guys had also said, that being said, don't be afraid to actually take people off pills down the road. And if you actually said, well, that was weird or whatever happened, but now we're at whatever numbers and or they're not feeling well on the medications, that's time to revisit. So there's more than meet the eyes, and it's not just treating numbers.
Yeah, and I was going to say the key, one of the key things is we want – the healthcare provider not to panic.
Oh, absolutely.
Because that sets off the process. And people can read by even body language, with these sorts of things. And if you go, that's an interesting, your blood pressure is 180 over 110. Here's all the potential reasons why, and blah blah blah. And this is the potential risk, and it's why we don't want to be too aggressive. But we should do something about it. With that sort of approach, I mean, I'm sure that's what you guys do.
Yeah, you got to be careful for sure that you're not sending them signals that make them.
Yeah, I mean, if all of a sudden you're grabbing their cell phone and going 911.
And as Bob used to say, A blood pressure is better than no blood pressure. So
What is it? Yeah, high blood pressure is better than no blood pressure at all.
Yeah, for sure.
So anything else you guys want to add to this? It is a tricky area, but boy, you guys see a lot of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So let's talk about the next Alberta course. When is that coming up?
So the PIPE conference, if that's what you're talking about, October 2021. It's in lovely Edmonton. And if you don't want to come to lovely Edmonton, you actually can sign on by webcasting. And we actually had it was fantastic. So we had 150 people from across Canada sign on webcasting, which still allows you to ask the presenters questions. So
you guys allow that.
Yeah, if you want to stay in your fuzzies and your pajamas. And
yeah, there's people who told me later they loved it because they got up a little bit later than they normally would, wandered in, turned on their computer, had their coffee, and were in their PJs.
Yeah, lovely, lovely. October 2021.
And because of that, that's why when I was there, I presented in my pajamas.
Yeah.
Make them feel better.
Yeah.
And not to go above and beyond that course, but if you want to come to Vancouver in May of 2018, the Best Science Medicine 2-day course will be May 4 or 5. And usually we have pretty good weather in May, but there is no guarantee, but it could be lovely. So you should think about doing that. Continue to check out the Tools for Practice. Go to our website and see all the cool tools that we've developed. We're going to be doing a bunch more podcasts. We're going to probably do some stuff on lab tests. Anything else that we're going to do, Mike? that you can think of?
No, because I've got one on CBC we need to talk about. Yeah. And then we have the members of our team. Our team has recently expanded here, and they'll be coming on to do some of the brand new studies type nice. Podcast.
Cool. Okay, so I think we'll leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.
So long for now.